Welcome to another NetFlow-focused episode of Software Gone Wild. And it all started with an interesting story. When I published the podcast on NTopNG with Luca Derry, someone quickly sent me a note saying, well, you might be interested in this other stuff. There is this other guy that used the N-probe and combined that with the Elk Stack. This other guy turned out to be Clay Curtis. Clay, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And when I was looking for a co-host to ask intelligent questions, because I know nothing about NetFlow or Elk Stack, I remembered my good friend Eliza Jasinska. She was dealing with NetFlow in one of her previous jobs, as we discussed on one of the early episodes of Software Gone Wild. And now she's independent and obviously interested in all things open source. So welcome, Eliza.
Thanks, Ivan.
How are you doing? What are you doing these days?
Right now I work for Presidio. It's a VAR in the United States. I do professional services and managed services. So I basically have been working on just standard route switch projects, data center projects, and things like that.
So you sound like a traditional networking engineer, right?
Yes.
How did you get into these open source waters then?
It actually started in my last job. So I kind of was in a general systems administration position. Most of my focus was network engineering related, but I actually had to monitor or manage a lot of Linux and Windows servers as well. So, you know, after about 6 years of, you know, running Linux, it just kind of comes with the nature of running that. That's how I kind of got involved in that.
And Eliza, what are you doing these days?
Yeah, I'm apparently here to ask some questions. I'm not really sure.
Apart from the time when you're on the podcast, obviously.
Apart from the time that I have that has been more and more recently, I'm a regular on those podcasts these days. Thank you, Ivan.
Well, you are now officially my co-host. So welcome to the club.
All right, thank you. Yeah, other than that, I'm with Big Wave IT now, also working on freelance and consultancy stuff and enjoying the summer and hopefully going on vacation on Monday.
Perfect. So let's hope it works out, because you wanted to do it like a week before, right? And it didn't work out.
Plans are flexible, really. I will hopefully be gone by Monday, and I hopefully won't be back for at least a month. So,
wow, me jealous.
Yes.
Clay, what have I told you about these Europeans, you see? This is the reason I can't publish anything in the summer.
Yeah, that's a long vacation. It's a little different here in the U.S., I think.
Right.
Not as much vacation.
Well, Eliza was working for Netflix and Microsoft before, right?
That's right. And now I have a summer off, so you need to make use of that.
So how much vacation did you have in those two previous companies?
Like a week or so. Yeah, exactly. I think my last extended vacation was in between Netflix and Microsoft. So this is the time.
Perfect. Okay, so let's get back to NetFlow. Clay, it all started, as I said, with a blog post you wrote. Where you described how you combined N-probe with Elk Stack, right?
Yes.
So why would you ever do that?
Well, at this particular customer, there was a requirement to capture 100% of the flows, and the platform that they're running in the data center would not allow that. It was a hardware limitation with a Nexus 7K platform. So they really needed to get those flows, and there just wasn't a good way to do it. Out of generating native flows off the 7K. So that's when I started looking around and found N-probe.
And not to bash just the Nexus 7K, there are very few platforms that could actually do non-sampled NetFlow at reasonable rates, right?
Right. So yeah, I don't have any experience with those other platforms in regards to NetFlow, but yeah, it is a pretty tall order.
Eliza, what's your experience with that?
I've usually been dealing with sampled flows in higher speed networks in the first place. So if you're trying to capture it unsampled, but I mean, do those switches really send it out completely unsampled, or how do they do that? Because I mean, they at least aggregate up the flow as NetFlow does for some time in like the local K cache and then report on it, right?
Yeah, so I'm not sure on the mechanics of how it does it, but you know, when you try and set the sampling rate to less than, say, 1 in 1,000, it just wouldn't do it.
All right, but there is a sampling rate, so it's still like, okay, so it's still sampled.
Correct.
Yeah, that's the problem. They didn't want to have sampling.
No. I think they didn't want to have sampling, or they wanted to have every... Okay, let's step back here. So they didn't want to have sampling, or they didn't want to have every single flow, because that one does not necessarily exclude the other, right? And sampling, you just need to make sure you sample often enough so you would still catch on to every flow and not miss anything along the way.
So they just basically wanted every TCP UDP flow for security monitoring. So they really didn't have a good way to capture 100% of the traffic that was going through.
What speeds are we talking about?
It's 10 gig. So at their aggregation points, they're pushing, it's multi-gig. It's not full 10 gig, but they've got 10 gig to the internet. Then they've got a couple other circuits as well that were less. But, you know, we're talking probably on average 3 to 4 gig of throughput.
If I understand correctly, they weren't that focused on the exact traffic statistics, but more on logging the sessions.
Correct.
Okay, and how did you then stumble on the nProbe?
Well, I've used nTop in the past, nTop NG, which is kind of that has the web GUI on front and everything. And I had used it for that, but not really just nProbe itself. So I was basically looking for a way to take things off the wire via a span port or a network tap and generate flows off of that. And really, nTop and nProbe were the only things that I found that really could do it. I'm not sure if there's anything else out there, but that's what I came across.
Is that what it does? Because I've never used this before. So you actually just mirror your entire traffic and send it at a server or something that you run nProbe on, and then it will generate NetFlow out of your mirrored traffic? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is not at Netflix scale. And keep that in mind. So this is just a pretty standard data center network. So basically spanning one of the 10 gig interfaces off the 7K and just putting it straight into a server that's running nProbe.
So why would this, I mean, maybe I don't know the hardware platform either, but why would so seriously, the server is better at generating NetFlow than the hardware they were using?
Yeah, so this went up the chain at Cisco to the BU. I don't know all of the specifics of the underlying issue, but it was the line cards that they were using along with the feature sets that were enabled. It just wasn't able to do what we needed it to do. So there really just wasn't a way to do it like native in the platform. So in I guess to answer your question, yes, that it would appear that a server is better at doing it in this case.
That's crazy.
let's put these things in perspective. A mid-range server has like several times the CPU power of the supervisory board of the most expensive switches on the market.
Right.
So it's amazing how weak the CPUs and the networking gear are. I'm sometimes joking that they're still using the Z80 CPUs, if you remember them from the Sinclair Spectrum. And the other problem is that, you know, you do have only 10 gig, but the line card itself supports at least 80 gig. And if they were using the F2 line cards, they go even higher than that. And it's impossible to do NetFlow at 100 plus gig with reasonably expensive hardware at line rate. So we shouldn't blame the hardware manufacturers too much. Although, yes, it does sound crazy that a $5,000 server behaves better than $500,000 switch.
See, I always spend a lot of time tweaking the whole sampling situation on routers, because there is a huge balance between, you know, how high can you sample to still catch everything you want to catch in your traffic. So when you're looking at, you know, 1 out of 1K packets, is it still going to statistically, and there's some weird math behind it that I tried to understand a couple of years ago that I never really fully got, but how high can you set your sampling rate to still kind of statistically get a nice overview of what you're getting there? But yes, it will never be the full, it will never be every 100% every flow guaranteed unless you actually look at the full traffic. It's, there's something that's always going to fall through the cracks.
Yeah, but anyway, if you want to capture only at around 10 gig rates, then yes, mProbe is the way to go.
So what does mProbe do now? How does this go? You put this on your server, you put your flow there, and then what?
So you basically span the port off your switching infrastructure and connect it straight to one of the NICs on the server. And then mProbe is listening and will take that and parse it and output NetFlow or IPFix on another interface. So you have one for the actual traffic and then another that that sends flows to wherever. In this case, it was the Elk Stack.
Mm-hmm. And mProbe comes as a software package and also as a hardware product, right?
Correct. They have a product called Inbox, I believe is the hardware product.
Yeah, you're right.
But yeah, you can just run it as a software package on whatever you prefer.
And you were running it as a software package, I guess.
That's correct. Yeah, they had a mediocre server. I don't remember the specs on it now. It was an HP server. And so we just stood it up, plugged it in. Now, I labbed it out, of course, to see if this would actually do what we wanted it to do, and it would. So, yeah, after plugging it in, everything just worked fine. Didn't really have to mess with it too much.
And then you said it sends out NetFlow or IPFix. And mm-hmm. you mentioned, I think, in your blog post or somewhere that it also sends out JSON.
Correct. So I was digging into the user guide for mProbe, and there was a specific command line argument for JSON tags, and as well as 0MQ. And so I knew that Logstash already supported that. So that's what kind of got me thinking, oh, maybe I can just dump this into Elk Stack, which they already had. So that was kind of a nice fit. So basically what it does, instead of taking the flows and exporting them typically like you would NetFlow, it's actually just taking the data and encoding it in JSON, and then the transport to get it from mProbe to the Elk Stack is via 0MQ.
And 0MQ is like a messaging mechanism, right?
Correct. There's a few of them out there, you know, Redis, and I'm trying to think of some others off the top of my head, but yeah, 0MQ is just a way to get the messages from point A to point B, basically. So what you would do on mProbe is you set it for the JSON tags, and then you give it, turn on the 0MQ endpoint, and that's listening on another port on mProbe. And then you would go into Logstash, which is part of the Elk Stack. And for one of the inputs on there, you would set it to the mProbe address and port where 0MQ is listening.
Okay, you've mentioned Logstash and you mentioned Elk Stack. What are they?
Right. So Elk is Elasticsearch, Logstash, and Kibana. So there's three separate mechanisms. Logstash is what actually takes the different inputs and parses them, and then it can export them to various destinations. And then Elasticsearch is the actual storage for that. So it's basically a NoSQL storage platform where you can just store what they call documents in there, which are, in this case, would be individual flows, would be stored as documents in Elasticsearch. And those are indexed for a very quick search. And then Kibana is the web interface that allows you to query Elasticsearch.
And so Elasticsearch is like a database.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not the typical relational database. It's like the NoSQL flavors that are out there.
Yeah, object-oriented, text-based, yada, yada. And Logstash is the front end where you take the data and put it into the database, right?
That's right.
And you used it to store NetFlow data. What else can it do?
Well, originally my use case was to aggregate firewall logs. And it was doing this via central syslogging. So I had already at this customer set up central syslog and was dumping everything into there and just, tail and grep to search all firewall logs simultaneously. So that was my original use case, but it can take really any kind of time series data and allow you to do real-time search and analytics on it, which is really nice.
Did you have any issues looking at the data? So I remember when we were piping data into Elk with Kibana had, you could really, using it, you could feel it was meant for log files and kind of the aggregation methods and everything that you had in there that you could, how you could customize it was really tailored towards log files versus traffic data. So there were a couple of things that we were missing when we wanted to then look at NetFlow, which in the end ultimately kind of resembles traffic data. Or how were you looking at the NetFlow data sliced and diced in Kibana?
Yeah, you're right. It's a little bit tailored towards systems data, but it really, it's just data in general. So all of the data coming in, you know, you can really slice and dice it. It's kind of doesn't really matter what type of data goes in there. In fact, we're actually dumping network data along with web server logs, database logs, exceptions, everything, application exceptions, everything would be logged into there. And then in Kibana, we just make dashboards, you know, for the different slices and dices that we needed to see. So I'd be doing things like top in aggregation, so top sources, top destinations, traffic profiling, so what type of traffic is it at an application level. Throughput, you can do throughput aggregations as well to see how much is actually going through. Now, I know there's actually a fork of Kibana called Kubana. I just started reading up on that, and it's geared more towards network data. So I'm interested to look at that. It probably has more what we're looking for network statistics.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You guys obviously know what you're talking about, and you're losing me, so.
Oh, sorry.
No, okay, that's fine. So if we go back to the nprobe, it's doing NetFlow, which means that in the end, for every session, it has source IP, destination IP, source port, destination port, and some counters, right?
Yeah.
Anything else you were collecting with the mprobe, like maybe remote BGP AS number or something along those lines?
I wasn't really a requirement in this particular job, but yeah, I mean, it can do a lot of things. So particularly with the IP fix, you can actually on nprobe, you can specify a template. So there's a lot of different fields that you can extract from it, and you can specify that in the template of particularly what things of interest that you want to capture.
If the hardware supports it.
Right. No, this is a software platform. mprobe is a software platform, don't you?
Oh, right. So if right, okay.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, there's all kinds of different fields. I mean, you can do destination AS or let's see what are some of the others. Yeah, there's even some HTTP things. So HTTP host, method, refer, URL, application latency, all sorts of other fields that you can put in your template and export as well.
Hey. Does it mean that mprobe is actually doing deep packet inspection into HTTP traffic?
Yes, it does. Yeah. So there's another module in mprobe. There's actually a lot of them for deep packet inspection and application level protocols. I can categorize quite a few of them. I don't know how the list, but it's a lot.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. So people, if you're interested in mprobe, there was this NTOP NG and mprobe podcast with Luca Derry, the author of these tools. So go and listen to that one, and you'll find it in the list of episodes of Software Gone Wild, obviously. Okay, coming back to your particular project. So you were collecting effectively the five tuples and some counters.
Correct, yeah.
And then you were sending those things in JSON format, which is just some text format with names and values. And you were using 0MQ, which is just some transport mechanism, and you dumped everything into Logstash.
That's right.
So in Logstash, in the end, you had a record for every flow that ever crossed your WAN link.
That's right, in theory. I mean, you know, I suppose there's a possibility somewhere dropped that we're unaware of, but it didn't appear to be. You know, we did some spot tests and, you know, we couldn't make a flow that we couldn't capture.
Which is awesome. So let's say you have almost all the flows. It's not, you can never guarantee that you capture everything, but you have like almost all the flows in Logstash.
Yeah.
And I guess then you can use Kibana and you can summarize on the source addresses or on destination addresses or on port numbers or on whatever, right?
That's right. And the, you know, the nice thing about it is if you're dumping additional data besides network data, you can correlate this network data with application data as well. So, you know, IIS or Apache server logs, things like that, you can actually do correlation. You know, if there's a performance issue on the network, you could actually then correlate that with application level performance issues or 500, you know, server errors or things like that that might be generated. So it's kind of nice that you can be able to correlate that kind of information from two separate systems.
So how would you do that?
So basically in Kibana, you would build a dashboard that's showing aggregations from multiple different sources. So from network information as well as, you know, application level information. You could display that in the same dashboard over the same time frame, and you could glean information out of that by doing that.
Yeah, this sounds amazing.
It really is. I've never really had the capability to do this before, and it really is useful. It's been very useful. So, you know, I've been using Elkstack now for about a year and a half, and it's just like, now that I have it, I don't ever want to be without it. So it's just extremely useful.
By the way, two things come to mind. So you've been using this for a year and a half now, and you've been dumping everything into it from web logs to database logs to NetFlow records.
Mm-hmm.
How big is this stash of data now?
Let's see. So in a different deployment, actually, we're pulling in about 21 million log entries a day. And, you know, we are keeping 20 days of it, I think. And I mean, it's really not that much. So I'm trying to think of exactly how much it took up. I could look it up here in just a minute if I had to, but all things considered, I think it's under 500 gigs for 20 days worth of network data for a substantial size company. So it's really not all that much. And the nice thing also about Elasticsearch is it clusters very well. So you can just scale horizontally with Elasticsearch, and in theory, you can grow it as large as you need to.
You're not storing like a year and a half of data. You have like a circular buffer.
Correct. Yeah. So there's a function. It's called the, I think it's Elasticsearch Curator, which actually you just schedule as a cron job that purges the old data. But you can, in theory, keep as much as you want as long as you have enough storage to support it.
Is there any option of like consolidating the data and storing just the summaries or something like that?
Be honest, I'm not sure on that.
I don't think it does any aggregation type things.
Yeah, you mean like RRD, where it just, you know, summarizes and averages data older than a certain time frame?
Yeah,
you would probably just do it on the database.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure how to do that.
Yeah, you can probably just write your own script that does the aggregation and dumps the results back into Logstash.
Yeah, in theory, yeah, that would probably work.
Anyway, with 500 gig of data, how fast does it work?
It's actually very fast. So, and that's another thing that the scale-out feature of Elasticsearch is nice. So it's not just scaling out on storage. So the actual indexes are sharded into, which shard means just a piece of the database. So the chunks are allocated across all of your nodes of Elasticsearch. And then when you go to do a query, you're actually querying all of the nodes in Elasticsearch. So it's basically a distributed search across those nodes. So you can search, you know, over 20, whatever, you know, 30 days, let's say, and you have all these aggregations that you're searching for in Kibana. It's actually distributing that search load across all of the Elasticsearch nodes.
It sounds almost like a Hadoop cluster, right?
Yeah, it's very similar.
So if you need more data, or if you need faster responses, you just throw more resources at it.
Yep, just spin up another Elasticsearch server with some additional storage. It joins the cluster, and that's it.
Does it do any data? Because I've tried playing with that before, but I always got stuck having it kind of on one database and never really got into the sharding and multi-database. So if you shard that and try to like connect your three databases together, does it keep all the data sets on each server, or how does it exchange?
So there's some, it does it all automagically, if you will. So you specify in the configuration file of your Elasticsearch servers, how many shards you want, how many duplicates you want. So if you set those settings correctly, you'll actually have partial databases on each server, and then you'll have mirrored copies as well that are distributed amongst the cluster. So you actually have protection there as well. So if an Elasticsearch node goes down, those shards that went down, they could be replicated already on other nodes, and then those would take over as master for those shards. So you can take, an Elasticsearch node out of the cluster, and you're not really hurting anything. You're not going to lose data, and you'll have a slight performance hit in search times, but that's about it.
Right, because at the time, because that was always my fear, at the time when it's actually busy copying that data and you're trying to, read something and you have, or write something and you have read and write operations going on at the same time, everything kind of gets clunky and busy.
Yeah, I suppose there's a case where if you're actively writing into a node and that node were to go down, yes, I suppose that would affect it.
No, but just in general, keeping the copies up, I always fear that I don't really know when it's reading data out of the database to like copy it to a different node somewhere. And that might be the time where I'm querying it for something too. And then I'm going to have a performance hit without really knowing why, because it's doing something in the background there. I don't know. It makes me uncomfortable.
Right. Yeah. So, I don't really know. Yeah, I really don't have a good response to that. I mean...
Yeah, it wasn't really a question. It was more like, I don't like this about it.
No, it's very simple. For 500 gig of data, you can afford in-memory copy.
Right, okay, yeah. Yeah, maybe it's just, Maybe it's a scale where you don't really have to worry about those things.
Yeah. I mean, 500 gig of memory isn't that expensive these days.
True that.
By the way, Clay, if you add new nodes to the cluster, Will the data automatically rebalance itself so that it's spread over all the nodes, or will that only happen for the newly entered data?
It will only happen for the newly entered data unless you migrate manually the shards that are existing. So for the Elk stack, the default is to create a new index every day. If you go from one day to the next and you've added a cluster or you've added an Elasticsearch node since then, the new index will be sharded and include that new node as well.
Ah, so the rebalancing happens once a day.
Once a day by default. I mean, you can make a new index, which is kind of like a new database table, if you will, or a new database. If you have it set for once a day, then yeah, you could do that. But you could set it for once an hour if you want, and then you would have hourly indexes.
Why would you do that?
Yeah, I know.
So all this sounds great. How do I get started?
Well, for InProbe, obviously it would be intop.org. And then for the Elk stack, it's elastic.co, I believe. They just changed their company name recently. So yeah, elastic.co. And you can get more information on getting started with it. The documentation is pretty good as well.
Or you just search for download Elk and you get it.
Yeah.
And how hard is it to set up? So how much time did you spend figuring this out and setting it all up?
Well, originally, I didn't really get good at it until a few months in, but it really doesn't take too much to get up and running. A couple of days and you're pretty much there. The hardest part with Elk stack in general is making the filters in Logstash to parse your unstructured data. So in the, with the case of InProbe, it's not really unstructured data. They're already putting in a JSON. So it is very simple to get that into Elk stack. But, any kind of other data sources that you might be doing that, like syslog, for instance, they're semi-structured. But, in order for me to pull out source IP, destination IP, et cetera, you have to write rules in Logstash to parse that. And that's probably the most confusing part, because it does involve some regex, and a lot of people aren't that comfortable with that.
Ah, Perl.
So, in defense, though, Logstash does a lot of that already with Grok, which is one of the modules in Logstash. They have some patterns files that already have a lot of different network vendor log types in there. So they've already done the regular expression hard work for you. So you can just use that template in your configurations. You don't have to write native regex. But, you know, for certain platforms, they might not have something written or some custom log format. You would have to write that. But all in all, that it's not that hard to do.
So effectively, you have to parse the text files so that you get from lines of text to structured data that you can then search on.
That's right.
And you mentioned in your document that now with mprobe, you don't even need to go through JSON and 0MQ, right?
That's right. So just like 3 or 4 days ago, Intop, they just published a blog post about it. The new mprobe 2.0 actually has exports native for Elasticsearch. So you can actually just dump straight from mprobe directly into Elasticsearch. So you can circumvent the Logstash portion of that and just write straight into the database. So it's very nice. It's going to make it a lot easier.
Ah, so you don't even need Logstash anymore.
That's right.
Awesome. So thank you, Luca. We love you.
The thing that you would sometimes, I guess the thing that you would sometimes want Logstash for still is to replace data. We've been doing those things where, like, we were replacing, I don't know, AS numbers with company names, etc. That's where Logstash would be still useful.
Yes, absolutely. So if you want to filter and munge the data or do some kind of modification on it, then you would still have to run it through Logstash. Definitely.
I actually like it a lot, because then what, you know, in the previous world that we know with like relational databases, all of that, you get rid of all the joins, all those like separate tables that you have lying around to figure out what the names are or what descriptions are. You just insert them on the fly with Logstash, but it's kind of the whole attitude of the NoSQL database thing, where you just kind of have more data in each record versus trying to merge it all on the fly.
Elisa, as a guy who had to pass an exam in databases at university, I can't tell you how disappointed I am at your denormalizing activities.
We've moved on. It's 10 years later now, at least. Come on.
It's 25 years later, actually.
Right, yeah. Okay. I don't want to know what database you're talking about.
Relational database with fifth normal form. Come on.
Oh my God. Those terms ring a bell. Unfortunately, they do.
And now you guys are losing me.
Okay, we don't want to go down that
path. This is like the university database class 101 or something like that. I don't know, where they dive into all that theory that no one really ever uses afterwards anymore.
Well, the theory is not that bad, because, you know, if you have the same information all over the place and you change it in one place, guess what? You still have the old data in the other places. So there is some reason for that theory, but let's not go there.
Still don't want to go back to university now.
Ah. Clay, where can people find you? Where can they find your blog post on these topics?
Yeah, so I have a blog post. It's www.networkassassin.com. And right now there's not much content on there, but I'm pretty busy. Hopefully there will be more soon. And then also on Twitter at ccurtis584.
Oh, by the way, don't make excuses for your blog, because it's awesome.
Oh, thank you.
And it's not so much about the quantity of the content, but the quality and the usefulness of the content. What I found there was extremely useful, and I'll definitely include those two blog posts in the show notes so that people can find them. Elisa, where can people find you?
People can find me on bigwaveit.org, or sometimes a little bit on Twitter too, at bigwaveit. I'm still baffled and trying to wrap my head around the fact that a server's actually doing all the flow work here. I'm so not used to this. We're like 45 minutes into talking and I'm still thinking about this.
Ah, that's why you've been so quiet today.
Maybe a little.
So Clay shocked you in the third minute and you were like,
now what? Exactly. Exactly.
Great job, Clay. I haven't seen anyone being able to shock Elisa. So thank you both for being on this podcast. This has been great, and I hope that a lot more people will stop using the reassuringly expensive tools and turn to Elk Stack and Nprobe to do their traffic monitoring and collecting.
Go open source.
Yeah.
You're already saying goodbye here, but so speaking about collecting, we're talking about flow data here. We do need to speak about the tool with the unpronounceable name for at least a minute, right?
Oh, yes. Here's the plug for PMHHT. Go, Elisa, go.
Right. So I guess it's out of the question here because it wouldn't take a full data feed and then generate flow data out of it. Although I do believe what it can do is make S-flow out of NetFlow or vice versa. It had a couple of like those translation functions in there, but not just take regular traffic and generate flows out of it. But when it comes to open source flow accounting, that's typically what I've been using so far is PM account. That also integrates with Elk, etc. these days. So that's my favorite way to go.
Okay, so now we have like three different methods to get from packets to database. You still need a NetFlow collector.
You still need a NetFlow collector. You would need a router that actually can send your NetFlow.
Or you use Nprobe.
Or you use, well, if you use Nprobe to send it, I'm not sure if it makes sense to have a different collector at the other end, because wouldn't Nprobe kind of just come with Ntop and then you're already set up?
Well, Nprobe can be NetFlow collector. No, sorry, NetFlow probe.
Yes, the probe, and then it can send it to PM account, and then PM account could put it into the Elk stack. Yes.
Yeah.
The reason really I've been mostly using PM account was because the routers were not able to insert BGP information, and then if Nprobe already does that on the server and fills in all the destination ASs and AS path, etc., then you don't really need that anymore. But if you're stuck with flow data that comes out of a router and you'd want to know your AS path and you can't because your router won't insert, if they don't support it, they just won't insert those fields and they just come out empty, then you can use PM account and give it a BGP feed and then fill that in afterwards.
Thanks again, Clay. Thanks, Elisa, for being on this podcast. And if you stumbled upon this MP3 by accident, you've been listening to Software Gone Wild. This is a podcast on everything software-defined, including software-defined networking and network monitoring and whatever is software-defined has to do with networking. And if you want to listen to other episodes, go to podcast.ipspace.net. And if you want to know more about SDN, there is a whole list of SDN resources at sdn.ipspace.net. And if you want to listen to future episodes, obviously, there is an RSS feed, and it's also in iTunes, so just subscribe, and the episodes will automatically appear in your podcast listener. Thank you for being with us, and see you in a week or so. Let me just try one stupid thing.
What's he trying there?
Trying to bring Luca Derry in. This would be awesome, but he's not online.
Explain yourself.
No.
Okay, well, maybe not now.
No, he's not online. Luca is author of Nprobe.
Right. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask him whether he can insert AS numbers into the flow records.
Well, at the collector side, I don't know, but apparently Nprobe does that out of the traffic right away, so that's cool.
Yeah, but then he needs to take in the BGP feed.
Yeah, how does he do that?
Exactly.